Blog Talk Radio.
Carol the Coach. Sex, love, and relationships. We talk about it here.
Carol the Coach. Compassion with contemporary relevance.
I am a psychotherapist. I can be your personal life coach, and I can help you with your issues. There are no problems too small or too big. You can talk about anything.
Speaker, columnist, radio TV host, and commentator. Carol the Coach brings messages of wellness and empowerment within reach of everyday people every day.
Almost 5 years ago, I lost my soulmate in an accident. He was killed in a plane crash. Life just for me has seemed to stop.
There are groups all over the city. I mean, I teach one. It is a specific way to start thinking so that you shift how you see the world, which then shifts your energy, and then you feel better, and you actually see things differently.
Carol the Coach. Always available to at carolthecoach.com.
Now, I've got Russell on the line.
I'm 47 years old. I'm a truck driver. I am married. I have a wife in San Francisco.
Okay.
I haven't been home in 6 months. My thing is, I don't know if I have a sex addiction or what the problem is. Why do I want what I can't have? And as soon as I can have it, I don't want it anymore.
You're right on target when you say, I don't know if I have a sexual addiction. Well, guess what? Yes, you do. And you know what? That's my specialty, Russell. So you're at the right place. Continue.
I meet women online, and I'm in a different part of the country. I travel all 48 states, so I love sex.
I hear self-esteem issues. You never felt good enough, and you didn't feel like you were getting what you should have then, and you're reenacting that now. Do you want to change that about yourself?
And you know, if you want to change that about yourself, then I'm here to tell you, I'm Carol the Coach, and this is the show to help you do it. You know, sexual addiction comes in all forms. And I can't stress enough that if you feel like you've lost control and you are engaging in behaviors that you know you wouldn't be talking to other people about, there's a level of secrecy to it. If you're spending money that you don't have, and for a lot of people, if you're spending time on the internet, just think about this for a minute. Have you ever lied to anyone about your porn use? How about it? Have you ever taken time to hide something from your partner? You know, maybe you've contacted somebody on the net, and right now you're just talking, so you're able to rationalize that it's no big deal, everybody does it, and it's not going to go anywhere. Perhaps you've met somebody and you've cut it off, you've had sex, but you've stopped, and yet you're fantasizing about that man or woman, and you're masturbating. These are all reasons to really take a look at your behavior and to ask yourself, is my behavior out of control? I guarantee you, if you're asking the question, you know the answer. And truly, sexual addiction takes you away from your family, your work, school, friends, your sleep, you know, your ability to pray or be close to God. You know, we say that sexual addiction is an intimacy disorder, and it's also a spiritual disorder. Because there is no doubt that it keeps you from finding that closeness that builds your self-esteem. And that's why in the intro we're talking to Russell. And most people suffer self-esteem issues anyway. But people who have had sexual addiction in their background have either created such a habit disorder as so many obsessive-compulsive behaviors that they cannot stop. It's getting worse and worse and worse. It's progressive. My guarantee to you is don't fool yourself. It doesn't matter if you stopped for a week, a month, a year. Most people will go back to it. And when they go back to it, they not only start back, not at the place where they stopped, but they actually increase whatever their sexual addiction was, usually twofold within 6 months. You know, it's the same thing with when you diet. What do they say about dieting? If you diet and deprive yourself, oftentimes when you relax, you end up 10 pounds heavier than where you were when you started. And so this show is for you. You know, tonight we've got two of my favorite guests, John and Elaine Leadham, and they wrote One in the Spirit. It's a meditation course for recovering couples. And although they talked about their book, I believe it was in May, we're going to have them on every month, and they're going to be talking about something that is just absolutely part of sexual addiction recovery. And it's about building trust. How do couples that have had sexual addiction in their relationship, how do they rebuild trust and how do they repair it? And what I love about John and Elaine, and I wrote it in the intro, is that clearly these two people are licensed clinical social workers in New Jersey and Pennsylvania, and they've trained, as have I, with Patrick Carnes, and they have been practicing 12-step philosophies and addiction work. If you total their recovery over 75 years, even though they're not that old, we're combining it. And what is interesting is they don't necessarily ascribe to some of the things that you hear in a 12-step program. And so you can tell they have minds of their own. They've worked with couples long enough that they have reason to believe there are some things that are healthier for couples maybe than what is actually advocated for or recommended in 12-step work. And so they are not shy at all about talking about what some of these things are. And they've lived the issues, so they know what it's like, and they've dedicated their life to helping couples to repair, rebuild, and rekindle not only the romance, but just the trust in the relationship. And that takes a long time. I had a woman last week, and she was with her husband, and I quoted something that Patrick Carnes quotes. You know, he says, you know, this process of recovery for brain neurocircuitry takes a minimum of 3 and typically 5 years to reprogram the brain to neurologically find other things to light up your brain in the arousal pleasure center. And boy, she got mad at me. You know, she sent me an email afterwards. She goes, why did you tell him 3 to 5 years? That's a bunch of baloney. This can be done in weeks and months. And she was mad, and I understood that. Even though I think I've said that to her before, that can be a scary process to know, wow, we're going to be working together for 3 to 5 years as a couple, talking about what do you do to establish new behaviors, what do you do to reinforce true intimacy, which also lights up the reward and pleasure center, but in a different way. And John and Elaine are going to be talking about making decisions to trust each other and taking that risk and needing to avoid playing the games that so often occur and, you know, the protective devices that occur when you just don't want to get hurt. And, you know, so often the couples that I work with, you have somebody who absolutely does not want to let his or her guard down because they're going to get hurt. They're fearful, and they're like, no, I'm protecting myself. So what is that? What happens is it creates these walls. And John and Lane say the walls have been erected around us to keep both the love and the hurt out. However, the hurt we felt from not having love remained within the walls we had constructed. And so this building trust process is fascinating. I will highly recommend that you give us a call. That number, go ahead and write it down now so that you'll have it, or get out your phones, 646-595-3284. And I'm just so pleased because so many of my listeners perhaps don't get around to listening to the show live. But boy, they check in through iTunes and through subscribing free, and they hear it later on during the week. Maybe they're mowing the lawn. Maybe they're washing the car. Maybe they're, you know, doing dishes. But they put their iPod in and listen to the show, and then they email me and say, boy, I had never heard that before. I really appreciate you sharing that information. So tonight is going to be a really good show. And I have a feeling that anybody who's experienced any infidelity, whether it's sexual addiction or not, could benefit from some of this stuff. Because I got to tell you, you know, I've worked with folks for a really, really long time. And when infidelity is part of the picture, the amount of anger, mistrust, and betrayal is almost toxic. And as a therapist, I'm oftentimes in between my clients kind of shaking off that toxicity, because you have two people that have been so pained and so hurt, and they're emoting and they're having trouble trusting. And, you know, when people say to me on a regular basis in terms of my regular therapy, wow, how do you do that? How do you work with people that are in so much pain? I typically say, you know what, it's because I see them get better. I see the success and I see the change. And I do that with sexual addiction too, but it's slower, it's darker, and there are more slips and relapses. And so rebuilding trust is very difficult if you've got somebody who has been working really, really hard on their program. They've been doing the bibliotherapy. They've been doing the spiritual work. They've been increasing their communication, and then they slip. And it feels like to the couple that they have to start all over again. And I know that's incredibly painful. And yet, again, the number one way you grow is by forming relationships and developing intimacy. So it's not only an investment in your relationship, it's an investment in you and who you are as a person. And so that's the exciting part. So, again, if you have any questions, give me a call, 646-595-3284. And I'd be happy to talk to you about any topic that has to do with sexual addiction, infidelity, rebuilding trust, how do you love again? And for some people, you know, they've never really had an intimate relationship anyway. You know, so many couples came from families where there was abuse, or there was what we call disengagement. Families were not close. Or on occasion, they're too close. It's called enmeshment. But truly, most people that have experienced sexual abuse come from rigid, disengaged families. And so that intimacy wasn't taught, it wasn't modeled, and that makes it very, very difficult. You know, it's like parenting. It's trial and error, and you slide by the seat of your pants, and you figure out what works and what doesn't. And what I know to be true from that Harville Hendricks Imago therapy is that we attract people to work through our own personal childhood issues. And so, you know, if I have a man who's an addict, and he hooks up with a woman, more than likely that woman came from a family where love was not modeled properly. And so she's already at a disadvantage. She hooked up with this man on purpose, and in some ways it's a gift. Being with a partner is a gift to work out your issues, work on your childhood issues, and develop what you really deserve in a relationship, which is intimacy. So I would highly encourage any of you who is having difficulty in your relationship to listen to some of the tools, the tips, the strategies, and the philosophies of John and Elaine Bleedham. And welcome to the show, folks. How are you doing?
Hello there. How are you? It's Elaine.
Hi, Elaine.
Good evening. This is John. Hi. How are you, Carol?
Hey, doing well. And how
Great.
About yourself?
Very good, Carol. Very good.
Very good as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I was so excited that you wanted to talk about rebuilding trust. And, you know, you have picked four topics for me to be highlighted monthly for the next 4 months. And so tell me a little bit about what made you pick rebuilding trust.
Well, we have worked with a great many couples over the 38 years that we have been in practice together. And whether that couple is coming from an active substance addiction or a codependency or just a rebound relationship, doesn't have to be suffering from the pangs of a betrayal related to a sex addiction, as an example. We encounter couples who experience trouble, challenges developing and maintaining trust in a relationship. It's so easy when the relationship first begins, and so much more work as the relationship begins to experience the challenge of day-to-day living, whether it's child-rearing, careers, or mutual recovery issues. So it's a pretty big issue in our clinical work, for sure.
No, I'm sorry, Carol. It's also one that just keeps coming up over and over, depending on, like John just said, maybe there'll be some work that a couple will do around building trust with parenting issues, but then down the road something comes up around finances. So constantly something that they stumble over and look for support and direction and help with from us.
Well, and certainly I was saying earlier that all couples suffer from this, you know, and addiction doesn't even have to be part of it, but when you have active or recovering addiction involved, it really does exacerbate the problems, and it heightens them to the point of a lot of toxic feelings like rage and anger and attacking. And so you all probably have a way of getting to the root of what's going on. Tell me, is there a strategy that you find your couples use frequently as a way of coping with feelings of mistrust within the relationship?
Well, Carol, I know that there's a couple of strategies that we often look at trying to help them with going after this, but oftentimes we will see that our couples will do something that we refer to as scorekeeping. And basically it's the focus that one partner will place on another of trying to keep score of what their wrongs are. And it may be that they're doing that because they want to justify their own wrongs. It may be because they're trying to create distance or avoid taking risks, you know, sharing about themselves or what's going on. But it's really something that creates a great deal of difficulty. And one of the strategies that we encourage often, and the one that we encourage no matter what obstacle that they're using to prevent building trust, is to really take that risk and to put aside that false belief that says, I won't get hurt if I do this. You know, I won't get hurt if I don't trust. I won't get hurt if I use scorekeeping, for instance, as a way to create distance between myself and my partner. I won't get hurt. And the truth is, in any relationship, and most especially in those that are relationships that we are most intimate with others and our partner, they're the ones that we most definitely are going to get hurt with, whether you have addiction or you don't have addiction. And to be willing to take that risk and to step in and expose yourself rather than tell yourself, I'm not going to get hurt, so therefore I'm sorry, I want to protect myself from getting hurt, so I'm going to do this, you know, whatever
mm-hmm.
this is, to create distance or to create that false sense of safety.
Well, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, John, what do you think?
Yeah, scorekeeping, as Elaine has described it, is really quite a detriment to building trust and building a bond in a relationship. We encourage couples, instead of the traditional scorekeeping in which they look to blame the other person for the quality of their own life, or when they are being challenged by a partner about some wrong they have committed, typically our clients will go to the, well, what about you? What about you? What about you? And that scorekeeping is going to create a greater and greater distance between the two people. If you're going to keep score, you ought to keep score about what you have to be grateful for in that relationship. What has your partner done for you that is special and trustworthy as you look at the development and the history of the relationship? And to look at that gratitude list with regard to your romantic partner in very specific ways. On thus and such a day, Elaine did this for me. She said this to me. It was very loving. It was very caring. Because when we feel hurt, we can remember exactly what the other person did to hurt us. And the whole cadre of examples come to mind. So if you're going to keep score, keep it about what you have to be grateful for your partner.
Boy, that takes a lot of emotional maturity, and I know when I practice that in my own marriage, I see immediate rewards. My husband's face softens, his tone of voice is different, and it's like he's appreciating me for appreciating him.
Yeah, you couldn't say that better, Carol. That's absolutely what happens for us as well.
Mm-hmm.
It is the anti-Hallmark experience. And Hallmark would like us to believe that they know exactly how to say the loving, caring, most endearing thing to your partner. And so we pay $3.75 for a card, and we have Hallmark say it. It's really going to be much more well-received if we say to our partner, I am grateful that you are doing thus and such in my life. And
right.
And we watch couples like you described your spouse lighting up to that, Carol.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's where there's an immediate gain. And, you know, I know that you suggest in your writing that it does not take time to build up trust, which you oftentimes hear just the opposite, that it does take time, lots and lots of time. So tell me about that, John. What makes you say that it doesn't really take time to rebuild trust?
Well, I spent about 25 years running addiction treatment facilities around the country, and I saw in those treatment communities the same thing I had observed in my own 12-step experiences, and that was strangers coming together, taking a risk to expose themselves to other strangers because of the crisis that they were in. As the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous refers to the fellowship as being a process of helping other survivors of the shipwreck, I would see every day in residential treatment communities strangers coming together, taking great risk and developing incredible trust in 28 days or less. I think a most tragic but perfect example would be the bond that we observed in the survivors of the 9/11 attack. Elaine and I had the opportunity to work as disaster mental health workers for Red Cross and got an opportunity to interview lots of folks that developed very intimate bonds with the survivors of that experience because they were under attack. If the crisis is great enough, it doesn't require a great deal of time to develop trust. It only requires a decision to do so.
Mm-hmm. And Elaine, say a little bit more about that decision. What might a man or a woman think and say to themselves as they're deciding to rebuild that trust quickly?
Well, what comes to mind for me, Carol, is using my own experience with that. I was raised in a family where the expression of emotions were, unpleasant emotions, I should say, were pushed aside. Oh, don't say that. Don't think that. That's not nice. You don't really feel that way, et cetera. So a lot of, there was a lot of complications in the family I was raised in because of it being with alcoholic parents. But my point being is that I came out of that system really not even trusting my own feelings, doubting that my read on people was anywhere near accurate or what the situation was the feelings that were going around in the situation, I really doubted a great deal about it. So I decided that I wasn't not only able to trust you, but I couldn't even trust my own feelings. I enter into also myself a 12-step recovery program and had much the experience that John just described, you know, where I find myself telling people things that I swore I would take to my grave that I would never say to people, and it was that bond. And basically finding out that it's exactly what John ended with, which was it is a decision. I really was going to either continue to follow the rules that I had made up in my own head about if you do this, Elaine, if you don't trust men, that was one of mine, if you don't trust men, you'll stay safe. If you don't trust this, you'll stay safe. I was either going to follow those rules and let that dictate how I was going to behave in my relationships, most especially my romantic relationships, or I was going to take that risk and make that decision to bring all my fears into the relationship and basically just ask the person. And it really sounds so simple, but at, you know, different times, that was a very frightening thing to do, to actually say, do you feel this way about me? Are you thinking this about me? Because I believe you are. Or any of those other things that come up, and just ask the person. Make the decision to take that risk.
So it's kind of like checking in with your partner and asking.
Yes, it is. And it's really, but, you know, it goes beyond just checking in, because checking in, it may be what I'll put out, you know, what's going on with me. I'll ask couples to do that, you know, tell your partner what is going on with you, what your feelings are, what your thoughts are, but also to take that next risk, which is instead of trying to mind read, to second guess or to manipulate to get the answer that you want, ask them. You know, many times couples will say to me in an individual session, they'll say, I wonder if he feels this way about me or thinks this about me. And it really doesn't occur to them, or it seems a little foolish when I say to them, ask them. And they look at me like terrified. You know, really ask him that straight? Yes, please, ask him and find out. Check out your reality rather than deciding that you know what it is. Our reality is developed based on a lot of our past experiences, many of which happened before we even came into this relationship.
Mm-hmm. I would almost think that most of them happened before you came into the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of that reenactment again. John, what do you think?
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. The ghosts that we brought into our marital relationship were such that I think there were bookies, if you will, all over New Jersey betting that we would never survive, that we would never make it to our first anniversary because of the baggage that we brought in to that relationship and that initial novelty and excitement and intimate sharing would lead you to believe, wow, this is the greatest thing ever, and this could never be a problem until the work begins to develop, and I have to examine the rules, the expectations, the antecedent life experiences that led to the development of some of my very worst defects of character, that are defects of character find romantic relationships as a fairly fertile environment in which to develop. And so if I don't deal with the ghost of the past, I am more likely to repeat the same experiences in this relationship and the next.
So as therapists, what do you see as very common ghosts or defects of character that come back over and over and over again and play out in recovery and in a relationship?
Well, we deal with a good number of sex addict couples that have experienced a tremendous betrayal, but it is also true with our substance addictive and other process addictive folks that what happens during the course of the progressive nature of the disease as the co-addict loses greater and greater power over their life experience, that relationship, they apply everything that they know to make the situation better without facing oftentimes the whale that's beached in the middle of the living room in terms of confronting the addiction. They will begin to experience all of the times in a very post-traumatic-like fashion, all of the times in their life when they were impotent in the face of addressing the crisis, the conflicts in their families of origin. And the expectation will be, this is the time that I'm going to do it different. And it isn't really different. And so impotency, powerlessness, the loss of ability to control, the inability to make the difference, to pull him or her away from this substance or away from that addictive behavior. There are so many examples of those ghosts. The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous suggests that one's drinking or one's acting out behavior is a symptom of an underlying spiritual problem. And that spiritual problem, in my case, was the belief that I needed to do this by myself. And by myself excluded my partner. By myself excluded sponsorship, those kinds of things. And that defect of character was going to have to be addressed, or I was going to continue to relapse. By the grace of God, that I have not, since I entered
recovery. Well, and obviously that's some of the walls that you two write about that go up when you're trying to do everything on your own. And how frustrating for you, Elaine, and yet did you understand what he was doing, or did it trigger something in you that had to do with your own defect?
More of the second, Carol, what you just said in terms of triggering my own defect of character. It would create that feeling of panic around rejection or fear of rejection or anticipating rejection or not being good enough, all the things that I, again, brought into the relationship, not necessarily anything that John was creating, but that I brought in to the relationship. And I can really identify that feeling of by myself, because that growing up in the alcoholic system that I did, that really ended up being, we all believed, me and my siblings and I, that was the safest strategy. Just take care of yourself, be quiet, and handle everything yourself, and that was, you know, believed to be a very safe strategy. However, when it was done to me, or how I perceived that it was being done to me by John, to me, it would give rise to all of that panic of, you know, I'm being rejected, I'm being abandoned, I'm not worthy of. And then I would create different strategies to fix that, which was to become more controlling or manipulative or testing, you know, how much does he really care about me, how much does he really love me, and look for ways that I could test him in order to get proof that I was worthy. You know, so that's really a rather unhealthy game that in the earlier part of our relationship, for sure, it became a compatible way that our defects of character were working, but that was very much unhealthy and detrimental to our relationship.
So then what was the formula for you personally, knowing that to get that kind of validation from John, obviously, you had to break that cycle. So what did you do instead?
Well, you know, as you know very well, Carol, it was and has been a journey and a process rather than a singular thing. But really, when you asked that question, the first thought that came to mind is I really had to decide that what I was bringing into this relationship really needed to be challenged, not decided upon, this is the absolute truth, Elaine, but really challenged. And the only way that it could be challenged was by letting John, as well as many other people, to share with me their point of view and not guard myself or defend myself and believe, again, that I had the answers. I know how to do this. And, you know, the way I always knew how to do this was, again, by myself. So the biggest step and the first step was letting others in.
Well, we have a question or a comment about what you two have been talking about, so I want to welcome the caller to the line. And feel free, what's your comment or question?
Hi. I really like, I could relate to what Lynn was saying about not being able to trust her feelings or the reality. I can really relate to that. I guess I have a question. If I can't trust my feelings, can't I test? Like, is there a way I can keep score with my husband so I can know if I can trust him or not?
John, Elaine, who wants to answer that?
Well, I'll jump in first, caller, and thanks for calling the show. We really appreciate your interest and your willingness to be vulnerable. But what Elaine was talking about with regard to trusting her own emotions is a byproduct of growing up in a fairly dysfunctional family, as commonplace as that is and mainstay as that is in this day and age. Growing up in a fairly dysfunctional family in which she was told in so many ways not to trust what it was she was feeling. That's not what you're feeling. That's not what you're thinking. That's not what you should be doing. And one of the things that she would learn to mistrust was her own feeling of love and her own feeling of intimacy and trust. And she would trust and love and care for and commit herself to these active alcoholic parents who were really not capable of reciprocating, and so she would learn not to trust that. My encouragement to you, instead of, you know, setting up tests for your partner to see if he really cares about you, is to tell him how you would know that he cared about me. So it would go something like, John, I'm feeling really insecure, and I'm not sure if you love me. It would feel like you loved me if you did this, if you did this. That's how I experience love. What most people are apt to say right away is, yeah, well, can I really trust it if I have to tell John how to love me? If he really loved me according to Hallmark, he ought to know what I need before I ask for it. But this process of building intimacy, caller, is one of communicating your needs to your partner and giving them the opportunity to show up and not test.
And also understanding that the way that I may experience that feeling of being loved by John may be very different than the way John would experience that feeling of being loved by me. And so, again, to stay away from that mind reading and put out there, this is what would make me feel loved. This is what would make me feel safe, you know, and rather than playing manipulative games and saying, well, if you really knew me well, if you really cared about me, if you really loved me, you would know this by now. Well, for one thing, we often hear couples say, by now he should know, or by now she should know. We've been together 10 years. Come on. But the truth is that we're evolving as people every day, and we're changing. So what made a difference to me maybe 10 years ago is very, very different now, today, 10 years later. I am not the same person, and for me to look at my partner and assume that he's the same person and that what I did 10 years ago is going to work today is really a misassumption on my part. Instead, put it out there and put it out there honestly, and you get beyond all these game playings and really have greater success, is what we observe not only in our own relationship but with the work we do with our couples.
So, caller, does that sound kind of risky to actually put out there what you need from your partner?
I was thinking that it sounds scary, yes. Mm-hmm. That.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not rocket science.
No, it isn't. So if we can, let me ask you, what might be one thing that you do need from your partner that you'd be willing to share with him or her?
I think it would probably be pretty easy for me to, like, I like physical touch, so it would probably be pretty easy for me to just say, look, can I have a hug? I think that might be a safe way for me to start.
Okay. What do you think about that, John and Elaine?
Well, I think that's a great place to start, but keep a goal for yourself that one day you're going to get to the point where you're ready to throw caution into the wind and play a game that Elaine and I played for many times in our relationship called King and Queen for the Day, in which we said to the other person, I need to be king for the day. Could you treat me like I am the most special person on the planet? And we have done King and Queen of the Day so many times in our relationship, it's almost fun. It used to be harrowing in the beginning because we were all preoccupied with whether or not we'd get it right. But playing King or Queen for the day sets you up in a position of really being not coddled and catered to, but loved and paid attention to in a way that will saturate you. I wish I thought of it myself. I grew up watching TV as my babysitter, and there was a show called Queen for the Day, and you got to get all kinds of special things done for you. So I would hope you start small and you keep a pretty high goal for yourself that I'm going to really put myself out there to my partner.
Well, and John, I'm glad you said that because I'm a big believer, you know, in stretching out of your comfort zone. So, caller, you said that one of the things that you like and that he's probably pretty aware of, too, is physical touch. So I'm going to challenge you this week to even take it one step further and communicate something else that you would really need or like and see how that works, and then give us a call and let us know on a future show. Okay?
Okay, I'll try it.
All right, thanks for calling.
Thank you so
much for taking my call.
Thank
you. Uh-huh. Yeah, it really does take a lot of guts and courage to put yourself out there and take the risk and potentially get hurt again. And so I'm always encouraging my clients to imagine being sprayed with Teflon and recognizing that if they don't get what they need, at least one of the things that they can do is know that it's not about them. It's really about the other person.
Yeah, and the other thing also, Carol, is that taking it, following your train of thought and taking it further, I'll often ask clients, I'll say, have you ever been hurt before? And, of course, they would say yes. And it, whether we're talking about the relationship that is of concern to them or a different relationship, and tell me what you've done about it. And, more importantly, you're here right now. What did you learn from that experience of being hurt? Or was it all useless? You know, what did you take from it? And oftentimes what's forgotten is we're so busy guarding ourselves about from another hurt because we think one more, I can't handle one more, it's one too many. We really lose focus that, you know, not only did we get through that hurt, but many times the hurts, you know, using my relationship with John brought us eventually closer together because it kind of propelled us into being more honest with each other or take more risk, because if we didn't do that, it would be possible that our relationship would have broken up like the many people predicted. You know, we really
absolutely. And in healthy relationships or relationships that are getting healthy, conflict breeds intimacy. So even if initially you don't get your needs met, it doesn't mean that it won't come around to that if given just a little bit of time.
Sure.
So I'm curious. Now, first of all, how can people learn more about you and your philosophy for how partners in recovery can take their recovery journey together?
Well, one of the things that you had mentioned at the start of the show was our book, our publication for couples in recovery, which is One in the Spirit, and we really have had great feedback about that. That's more specific to couples, and it's based on 52 themes to match the 52 weeks of the year, and one of them being building trust and having 5 days of talking about different obstacles or situations that come up around building trust with challenges that we put out there that couples face from our years of experience, as well as suggestions and strategies for them to try. So one of them would be that publication. We also have blogs and information on the Internet that we post blogs and other articles out there. Certainly, they can call our office if they wanted to, if they were nearby, if they wanted to make meet us and make an appointment, or, you know, there's other ways to make contact with us. Our phone number there is 732-797-1444. I mean, there's a lot of different avenues that we have put ourselves out there to be known by others, Is there anything else, John, you want to put out there?
Sure. In the coming months, probably in the early part of next year, we will be releasing a book specifically detailing how couples can work at building their recovery experience together. Its title that you can look for is Awakening to Your Soulmate. And it will outline the challenges and the strategies for building intimacy and trust, specifically in a recovering relationship, not necessarily peculiar to sex addiction, but to any addictive relationship, because we want couples to work together as a team. We don't want couples to work parallel programs. We want them to work integrated programs. Not a new concept. It's one that Father Joe Martin espoused in the early 70s, and it's just time that it is developed, and we hope to bring it to the bookshelves and to our website by February, March of the coming year.
Oh, that sounds exciting. So that's, again, going to be called Awakening to Your Soulmate?
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful. You're definitely going to have to keep us posted. And remind the callers, what is the name of your website?
www.leademcounseling.com.
And that's L-E-A-D-E-M, counseling.com. You know, I teased you, I hope you heard, that you really do have your own philosophies, and some of them are not exactly what mainstream 12-step programming discusses. I mean, you believe through your work with 37 years of working with clients that there are some things that they maybe perhaps can do that's a little bit different. So I have a question, because, you know, certainly there's a lot of clients that believe that, you know, recovering addicts or co-addicts would be better served by a decision to avoid dating people that are in recovery from an addictive disorder. What do you think about that?
Well, that's why the bookies were betting that we would never make it, because they knew something about our story. I stood at the altar on our wedding day, and without knowing it, my mic was not functioning properly, and so the whole front row of the church did not pass out. As I said to Elaine when we exchanged our own vows, I said, I can't promise that I'll stay married to you. I have never stuck to anything but sobriety. I will promise, though, that I will make a lot of noise when I am unhappy, whether I am unhappy about what is bothering me from my past, or what I am unhappy about what is happening in our relationship, or what you're not addressing in your recovery. And the priest that officiated the wedding got a little bit more sober that day.
I bet.
Elaine knew exactly what I was saying, and our two altar boys knew exactly what we were saying, because they were both recovering friends of ours. But
Let me guess. What you were really saying is you could not make an absolute promise that you would be with her forever, but you did promise to be authentic and transparent, which are two wonderful things if you're going to have a healthy, honest relationship.
Exactly. Perfectly put, Carol. Authentic and genuine and transparent with her. And I think we need to do that whether we are going to be with other recovering addicts in a romantic relationship or the garden variety non-addicted person. I really don't think that it matters.
Absolutely. And Elaine, you had to have fairly good self-esteem, because here is this man who is 100% sharing his real feelings, and yet another woman might crumble because they want to hear, oh, no, I'll be with you forever. And yet he was really saying, I will be myself forever.
Right? I'm giggling because when you said fairly good self-esteem, no, I can't say that. When he initially said it, I mean, not on our wedding day, but when we were dating, I was shocked, stunned, disappointed, many things. So my initial reaction was far from that. I really didn't understand that, you know, and I had other romantic relationships that were very different. In fact, more the person, the male person, was the chaser, and I was more the avoidant. So this was very different. So I had to really listen to John and decide. I don't know that it was self-esteem, but just decide, what are you saying? What do you mean by that? Because my first reaction was, as I said, it was negative, and it was coming from all my stuff that was clouded by my life experiences. I really didn't hear what he was saying, or I didn't really understand what he was saying. So the risk even back then was, tell me what you're saying, because I'm really not understanding what you're saying. You know, I'm hearing it through my ears that have my experiences, and all I'm hearing is I'm second, third fiddle, you know. I'm not, you know, the first, and I'm not being chased by you. And it was scary because transparency, again, I came from a system where everything was secrets, and I really wasn't prepared for that transparency. I was being taught it through my own recovery program, but I really was still very stunned by that idea of transparency. And the other thing that John had said also was accountability, mutual accountability. And again, what was modeled for me with what I saw in marriages, you know, specifically my parents, but others as well, was, you know, one stayed on their side of the street and the other stayed on their side of the street. And there was no mutual accountability. There was no giving of feedback. There was no expression of, I'm really concerned about you. This is what I see happening. There was none of that. You know?
Yes, and at the same time, though, you had enough self-esteem to take the risk of being with this man. And certainly it fits that you attracted him because he was going to push that envelope in you. And you were going to have to get healthier. You had a choice not to. But if you wanted to be healthier, you were going to have to work on dealing with his authenticity and his, if you will, John, in-your-face feelings.
Right. And you know, what you just said was the best way of explaining it. What I really, besides all that mess I just described and that, you know, insecurity or whatever that I had bouts of, what most touched me when I was able to say, what are you really saying, and really try to listen, was that, wow, he's really genuine. I mean, it did scare me because I still had a lot of game-playing tricks under my sleeves that I had learned in the dating experiences of my own. So it was intimidating in some way, but at the same time, it just felt so real that that really was the attraction, the very deeper attraction to John, amid all my fears and anxieties that I did have. That
yeah.
Is what drew me closer.
So I'm curious, guys. Obviously, John, you've made it a mission with Elaine to work with couples in recovery. You've written about it. You've got suggestions. Do you work with couples in group? Do you do couples groups?
We have done couples retreats, and we have done couples intensives for about 3 or 4 years. We work with a large group of recovering couples that, in a lot of ways, they joke with us about being our guinea pigs, because we tried out a lot of the principles that One in the Spirit discusses as strategies for building a sober relationship. We will continue to work with couples in a retreat setting and work with couples in intensives as well. When we release the new book next year, the intensives will be specifically around how you can begin to share recovery together and awaken alongside your soulmate. We don't believe that your soulmate is out there and you need to go find them. 9 times out of 10, that person is lying alongside of you in the morning. You just need to awaken to them.
So if you would, before we end, I'd love for each one of you to share a gratitude that you have for the other person.
I'll start off with a somewhat sobering one, and that is that on the day of my wedding vow, I regretted to find out a year later when Elaine betrayed our relationship in an infidelity, that she was not committed to bring the ghost of her past and the pains in her life to the forefront of the relationship, and it cost us an affair. And I am most grateful that we recovered from that affair together. I'm probably more grateful for that than having gotten sober 42 years ago, Carol.
Wow. Okay. And boy, I think that's phenomenal, because so many people are so hurt by that and aren't able to get beyond to recognize the gift that it can bring you when you both work on something together. So thank you, John. How about you, Elaine?
Yeah, thank you, John. I really am and remain so touched and grateful for John's willingness to not settle. There, from the very first moment that I met him, again, I told you I was more the avoidant type. He never settled with, if I would say, I don't know, it's not that important, or anything like that. There was always the expectation, but in a healthy way, in a caring way, the expectation of, I know you do know, I want to hear. I want to be beside you and not settle. And I am forever grateful for that, because I understand the risk that it took for John and continues to take for John to do that, because I also know his backstory very well and what he grew up in. But yet that didn't stop him from pushing forward and, you know, like I said, showing up 100%.
Well, thank you, Elaine. And, you two are both role models as well. If I can tell that you are obviously works in progress, you're constantly tweaking and revising what you need from each other and checking in with your own authenticity. And I so appreciate that you have made it your mission to work with couples, because, you know, it really... it's one of the best ways you can work on yourself is when you're working in relationship with another. So I can't wait to work with you again, and we're going to be talking about some great topics. Do you remember what those topics are?
I do not. Please don't ask me to recite them.
Okay. Well, I was just checking. Okay, well, I've got it here, because I'm really, really, really looking forward to getting to talk with you monthly. The next topic we are going to be talking about is we are more than our past. Common injuries and romances that share only common injuries run the risk of not enjoying many of the joys recovery offers. So, boy, that's a good one, because so many people are stuck in their past, and it's like they don't want to move out of that. And so I'm looking forward to how you're going to share that. And is that coming from Awakening? Your book, Awakening from the Soulmate?
Yes, it is, but I'm not going to spoil the future disclosure. It is coming from that manuscript, and you can also read more about the contents of that manuscript at Psych Central, where we blog on couples, at blogs.psychcentral.com/couples/. We will cover many of the issues that Awakening with Your Soulmate will introduce to couples.
Well, fantastic. We'll take a look at that blog. And until we see each other again, until we work together again, you two have a wonderful month. And thank you so much for contributing so much to recovery and being a couple. Thank you so much.
Thank you again, Carol.
Thanks for having us.
Have a good evening.
All right. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
So I really do feel fortunate, because you got these folks and they, you know, live together, work together, write together, obviously talk together and take risks together. And you could just tell from their dialogue that they're real, they're honest. It's not always smooth sailing, and yet they're very committed to their own growth and each other's. And that leads me to say to you, as I do at the end of every show, you know, there will only be one of you at all times. I want you fearlessly, fearlessly to have the courage to be yourself. And we'll catch up with you next week when we talk to another expert about how you can get healthy from the world of sexual addiction. Have a great week.